Hi there, it's Dr. Linda Papadopoulos with The Psychology Behind. Now, this week we have another extended special, and I love doing these because I truly meet some of the most interesting people, and this week is no exception. We have on Ian Sterling, who I think is one of the most talented comics out there today. The stuff he speaks about not only in an unbelievably funny way, but I think he's extremely intelligent and insightful, especially about the human condition. Now, what I did with Ian is what I do with all my guests, which is ask them for a toolkit for the things that they keep in mind to help navigate through life. So he speaks of a seminal moment, he speaks of an important comfort, and he speaks of a challenge or compass that helps kind of direct his behavior in the future. And the things that he alludes to are very thoughtful and very interesting. So I give you Ian Sterling. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me, Doctor. It is appreciated. And you've done my first podcast. And I feel like when I done the first podcast, I hadn't really thought it through enough. It's funny with the whole podcast thing, because at the start, you sort of romanticize it in your head. I'll just be a little like a chat and we'll be really interesting and fascinating. And then you realize, oh, you need some sort of structure or something to make it sort of have a linear to it, to make it work. So this is almost like my second bite of the cherry to do it right.
But we don't have too much structure, but I will ask you, the way that we do this is we kind of talk about a topic, but then I ask...
Well, already you've got a topic.
See? So
you've
got, well, there we go.
You're ahead of me already.
And then after that, I'm going to ask you for a moment, a comfort, and a challenge. And I think the way that we conceptualize that is kind of a moment in your life that was really seminal, something mm-hmm. that, you know, because I don't know, as a psychologist, I think one of the things that I love about my job is how privy I am to these sort of beautiful moments in our lives. They can be hard or they can be easy, but it's just that they can be really transformative. And I think mm-hmm. just having the chance to think about that and see what it was for you would be great.
Yep.
A comfort, what makes your life easier. We were always talking now about, you know, self-care and mental health and tools. And there's some really wonderful ones people have spoken to me about. So it'd be great to hear what that is for you. And finally, kind of how you orientate yourself, a compass, you know, how you set your goals and move forward.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all afterwards. But in the beginning, though, I want to speak about something that I know you and I both have quite a passion for.
Yes.
Talking about millennials.
The old millennial question.
Now, you write a lot about millennials in your book. And tell me, how did you begin to get interested in the era? You're a millennial yourself.
Well, yeah, I mean, the original interest came from the simple fact of I was writing a book and I felt like I didn't have enough personal life experience to fill it. You know, I felt like to talk about myself and what I'd done would have been, there wouldn't be enough in it to mm-hmm. sort of talk about, to make any point of interest, really. So I thought if I widened it out to my generation, but with personal experience, then hopefully I'd be able to sort of do more of a social commentary.
Okay.
So, and then from that, I started reading about it, and that's when the interest came. And then the more you read about millennials in general, you start to realise the stuff that does apply to you and the stuff that you maybe disagree with. And yeah, that's where the interest came from, basically, researching the book.
Yeah, because I've got to say, when I was sort of researching the area, I think your generation, more than any other, like sparked this interest. I mean, we've had identity for a long time, and whether it's sort of cultural or racial or, you know, age, but this sort of generational, apart from the baby boomers, I think more has been written about your generation than any other.
Yeah, no, and absolutely. And I think also the baby boomer generation was sort of a reactional generation to what had gone before them, whereas a millennial generation was sort of a product of society.
Yeah.
The millennials didn't come as a result of an external factor. They just sort of became that sort of nature nurture sort
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah.
So, and we were given the first generation, I feel like, to be given the freedom to express ourselves and find ourselves, and then we analyze ourselves,
yeah.
which other generations hadn't done. These would sort of retrospectively look back and go, oh, weren't we brave after the war? Or, you know, maybe they just got on with it, and then maybe there was some retrospect. We were constantly analyzing and looking at what we were doing and why we were doing it.
And I think the reason for that is the way that you were raised. And I think my generation, so I was born in the 70s, so I'm kind of in between sort of your generation and the one before, but mm-hmm. I kind of think of my goddaughters now who are in their 20s. One of the things I remember is this idea of removing obstacles. I remember this notion of if there's any problem, we solve it. And I remember even at the time, kind of studying psychology and thinking, you know, one of the things that always occurred to me was if you want to create a sense of just confidence. You do the stuff that you can't do. Like if you're doing stuff that you can't do, you know your confidence never increases. It's about doing stuff that you can't. And I think there's a need, like you say, there's a need for that story. It may not have to be I'm overcoming a war, but you need to overcome something. And I kind of, you know, you say it came from nowhere. I think the parenting around that time, that we raised a generation of kids saying, you know, everyone gets an award, or you're a rock star, or you're a princess, or you're beautiful. And then we put you in the worst economic crisis literally ever, where you can't find jobs, where you can't afford houses, where actually, you know, it's not, you know, Mexicans and immigrants taking your jobs, it's AI that's taking your jobs, and that's kind of inevitable. Yeah. And then we've said, well, why are you whining? Why are you being all day? So I kind of feel that it's bad deal for you guys.
It's a really interesting thing. Yeah, I feel like the generation before us, I mean, it's a really interesting thing, but they were sort of called the latch door kids. I don't know if you experienced this, where like people would live with their parents like they were roommates. I interviewed my mum for the book, and her mum was a single mum, and she had a blackboard, and they would write notes to each other about what they'd done, because they'd never see each other.
Because her mum was working so hard.
She was working away all the time, and then my mum would be at school, so she'd write down stuff like, oh, I learnt the sky's blue today, and she'd write, well done, proud of you, like a sort of like prehistoric WhatsApp. And then all these latch door kids sort of grew up and went, right, I'm going to make sure I'm there for my children, and I'm going to sacrifice my career and my dreams to make sure my kids have the attention they need and deserve. Yeah. So and then also, because there's that sacrifice, and it's not, when I say sacrifice, I don't mean it's necessarily a bad thing.
No.
My mum's given up a lot to bring up me and my sister, but I think she's incredibly happy with where she's at and the job that she does. But she never wanted me and my sister to feel like we had to sacrifice anything, our dreams in any way. So we were told, you can do what you want. And my mum would drive me to swimming class and drive me to judo and take me to football and just make sure that I had whatever I wanted. And it's that thing, like you said, which meant I was sort of brought up thinking, well, if I want something enough, then that'll happen, regardless of circumstance, ability, anything. And then parents you're told you're unique, you're told that you're special, because they think that'll make you feel better. And that does make you feel better and does give you more confidence.
Sure.
But it also sets this ridiculously high expectation of life. And that's happiness, isn't it? Happiness is essentially your expectation minus reality. So then you're left unhappy. Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. I think you're spot on. I think it came from a really good place, right? You know, someone was saying to me, I actually looked this up the other day, that the phrase follow your dreams increased on Google sort of significantly in sort of, you know, around sort of the late 90s, early 2000s. Before, it was like, get a good job, pay rent, you know, get something regular, you know, just don't get fired.
Have a family and be able to afford to keep that family in a house.
Yeah, exactly. Make sure they're fed. Whereas, you know, look, it's a beautiful idea, follow your dreams, but also I think we missed the pressure of expectation we were putting on you. And then of course social media comes into it. So at least you guys, like my generation, we weren't living out loud. Like, you know, I only bumped into friends from like uni, like sort of in the 90s. I'd be like, what are you doing? I could lie. I could say anything. I could be like, oh yeah, I'm like heading up an investment. I could, you know, end bank or whatever. Now you guys, it's out loud, everything you do.
Well, it's also that thing about, there's like research that shows like if you're communicating face to face, it'll be almost like a 40-60 split. And the person they're talking to is favour about what's happening in the world. You move that online, it's like 80-20. Like if you met someone in the street and they're like, I'm great, here's some stuff I've done, I've actually taken some photos of my job and then put a filter on it, trying to look at them.
Here's my yogurt.
Yeah, after a while you're like, I'm not going to talk to that person anymore. But now you like it.
Yeah.
So I think, we've got this world where my generation, we're told our life was going to be amazing. The reality didn't meet the expectation. But we have to keep up that pretense, so we go online and tell everyone that we are meeting our expectations. Yeah. And everyone that's worried about not meeting their expectations, they've got less face-to-face relationships, so they take to social media and they say everyone else is apparently doing such a great job, and then that makes you feel even worse.
Yeah, well, this is it. And look, you know, one of the things that worries me in the work that I do is that we know that depression's kind of rising in almost every age group, but nowhere more so than amongst millennials. And I think social media has a lot to do with it. And it's exactly as you said before, it's this differential between who I am and who I'm supposed to be. Like even with body image, I worked with it for years, and girls used to bring in sort of pictures of sort of other women models and say, like, I'll never look like that. Now they bring in sort of photoshopped images of themselves. Like, we can't live up to ourselves now. And there's a difference there, right?
Deborah Frances White, who does the Guilty Feminist podcast, I think it was on the News Quiz recently, told this amazing story about she had a photo shoot for like a show she was doing. And obviously the photo was like, not, I don't think she'd have it photoshopped. So just, I don't think she'd like to think people done that. But it was definitely made to look lovely. Yeah. And this photo was put in a massive big banner above her gig. And she had to hide from her own poster because she felt like she couldn't live up to the expectation of her own photo. So if you're looking at like Kylie Minogue, who's photoshopped and edited. No. I mean, even Kylie Minogue would look at that catalogue and feel bad about herself.
Well, of course, of course. And it's not just our looks, it's our lives, because it is, like, it's like you said, you post, you know, there's this really great research about when we post and when we surf. So we post when we're on a high, when we're on a holiday, when we're eating something wonderful, when we're out partying. And, you know, we surf and see other pictures when we're like at home with zit cream on, like eating leftovers.
Or when you get to the pub early and there's no one there. That's when I'm on Instagram. Like, I couldn't find the address here, so I stood outside another address for 10 minutes just going through Instagram. That's all you do. And again, it's that, and then again, it's that idea of perfect. And I think you talk about it, I really like what you said in Unfollow, is that thin line of perfect between something being perfect and it basically, well, not an absolute disaster, but basically a disaster. Yeah. Something that if you are told everything's going to be perfect in your life, then you are on a tightrope of, I've smashed it, that's perfect, and that was terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
And then also perfect, which ties into social media, relies on external factors, because you can't deem something perfect. Someone else has to tell you something's perfect.
But this is it. And I think that's the thing with self-worth, which I find really interesting. And again, I think your generation more than anyone else has developed their identity with the other looking in. So, you know, again, my generation, we were growing up, we all do this when we try on identity. So I try and be, you know, the funny kid or the smart kid or the cool kid. And it was people that had like an interest in who I was that would kind of reflect back. It would be my mother or my peers or my teachers, people that kind of knew me. Now, the people that reflect back to you what you're putting out there are people that really don't know you usually, but also don't have a vested interest in you becoming the best version of Ian that you can be.
Exactly.
It's just like, yeah.
Well, yeah, if you put up a picture of you being like really drunk before you've got an important meeting the next second day, loads of people will find that really hilarious and like it, and you'll get you'll be affirmed through that. But then people that know you are like, you should probably go to bed and make that important meeting. But that's not going to get the same sort of feedback. So social media is never going to emphasize all the positive aspects of your personality unless you are followed by just your parents.
Well, this is it. But there's also something about this kind of mini celebrity, right? Like, it used to be like the people that I saw that had this problem were people that were genuinely in the public eye, right? Yeah. Never resting from how other people see me, and we'd speak about the real me and the, you know, the me I put out there. And now you've got like 15-year-olds that can't rest from the idea of like, how do others see me? And that to me is what's really insidious, because if the only way that I can accept myself is if I feel that you being whatever group I've decided has value accepts me, then I'm always waiting for that next tweet, that next comment to kind of unsettle me. And I think that's why we're seeing a lot of sort of anxiety, a lot of difficulty in kind of knowing who we are and just sort of standing up for that.
Yeah, well, I mean, what social media is essentially consumerism's answer to a generation that wanted to be famous and wanted to perform.
That's the most brilliant line I've heard. That's spot on, isn't it?
That's all it is. What social media has done is let you watch your own life back at the end of the day as like a satisfied audience member of like a little film that you're in. You like edited it and directed it and lit it and sound recorded it and starred in it, and you can just go through it at the end of the day going, oh, look how great that is. And then instead of like, you don't have to be a movie star, you don't have to read reviews or anything, you can go look how many people liked it, or look at the most cool person at school, or like the most famous person that follows me on Instagram watched it, and like that's all it is.
Yeah.
It's just a little mini movie of you in it, and it's sometimes not even for other people, it's so you can watch it back and go, my day looked great.
Or it's so much for other people that you can't say it looked great until it happens. Like, it's that idea if a tree falls and there's no one there to hear it. Like, you know, if I experience something, there's no one there to see me experience it.
If a tree falls in the forest and no one boomerangs it, did it actually fall?
Oh, there you go. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about you, because I'm a huge fan of your work. I think it's so clever. I think it's so insightful. Now, given that we live in a time where we have to be, and I think rightly so, to some extent, careful of what we speak about. Mm-hmm. Like, one of my pet peeves is people would say, oh, I just say the first thing that comes to my mind. I'm a straightforward person. If we all walked around saying the first thing that came in our mind.
I hate that. I hate that. That's that thing on it online where it's like, I just speak my mind. It's like, you just be, but then you don't have to be nasty.
Yeah.
You don't need to be cruel to anyone.
Yeah.
There is absolutely no need for it. I find that really odd, that idea of I can say anything because I believe it.
Yeah, yeah. Feelings aren't facts, people. Let's just put that out there.
And even if they're facts, it's like, it's called being a human, kind and considerate.
Empathy, yeah. No, completely. But on the other hand as well, I think there's been this dangerous trend in the last few years of what you can and can't say. And I think it's two sides of the same coin. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you go too far to the left, you hit the right. You know, and I think the problem with both extremes is that we're in a situation where people feel that they want to speak about important issues, obviously in a calm way to get towards a better place of understanding. But because everything blows up and everything's very polarized, and you know, I'm gonna decide who you are and then tell you what you think before really hearing, it's really hard to have conversations. And I think that's the reason that comedy is doing so unbelievably well, because I think you guys are the truth tellers. I think you are able to say things in the way that many politicians, many influencers aren't, because you tell me, why do you think you can?
I suppose there is that sort of unwritten rule, if you're in a comedy environment, that sort of nothing's off limits and you can talk about anything. And I suppose you can talk about anything as long as it's funny. Like, your only goal as a comedian, ultimately your only goal is to be funny. Some people want to like make change, or you know, tell a narrative or tell a story, but if you're not being funny, then that is talking. Like, if you're not a comedian that's not being funny, you are talking. That's all you are doing. So it needs to be funny. And again, there's a lot of worries and the strain around things like what we can and can't talk about. A comedian is allowed to talk about it, and there's a pressure valve released there. And I mean, you can see it more and more. It's in America. I'm sure it's going to come over here now. A lot of comedians in America are not confiscating, but your phone is taken off you before you go into a gig and put into like a sort of locked bag, and then you get your phone back at the end, because context is incredibly important.
Indeed.
In a comedy club. So if you film someone saying something out of context and it goes on the internet, people have gotten a lot of trouble for that sort of stuff. And then again, you tell any sort of joke out of context and it sounds horrible.
Yeah.
There's any conversation you have, if it's taken in the wrong context,
well, absolutely.
Can sound terrible. Why? I don't really know why necessarily comedians have been given this right. I suppose it's by definition, that's what comedy has always been. Comedy has always been sort of like to ridicule the society you're in.
Yeah.
And if you're not making fun of something, then there's no point saying that everything's right, and there's no comedy in that.
But it's mirrors, right? I think you hold up. I think it's insight, it's mirrors. I think I think we all see the same thing, but I think one of the things that comedy does is it kind of takes away the BS. It's the emperor's new clothes. I think you're the guys kind of going, he ain't wearing any clothes.
Yeah.
And that's something that, because of these social contracts that we have between each other, we feel that we can't do sometimes. And I think that it actually serves a really important place in society. When you're writing your stuff, what kind of inspires you? What do you just look around? Like,
I mean, I suppose when it comes to writing comedy, now I've been doing it for like 10 years, I used to sort of like try and come up with a concept and write it down. I think now there's a sort of gear in your head when you're on stage where you're just desperately looking for the funny. So now I tend to just go on stage with almost nothing and then just start talking and see what happens. But that'll be done in an environment where the show's either free or very cheap, and the audience that have come to see it are fully aware of the fact that something might be just talking and some of it might be comedy.
Yeah.
So I think the idea is you write down a few ideas, things that you want to talk about, and then you go up there and start to talk about it, and your brain will find that gear in you. It's the same thing when you're writing like a book or doing a dissertation or you know, doing anything, until you actually start writing, your brain doesn't really get to where it needs to be to find it. So I definitely think the best way to do it is just to go on stage and you know
and just kind of like
and get it wrong. And sometimes, and in fact, getting it wrong is where you find it. And often, the little idea you have then leads on to something completely unrelated. But you just need a jump-off point, and you need to be in front of an audience desperately trying to search for that thing that's a funny thing to say.
Yeah, I love that you say that idea of getting it wrong, because I think you're absolutely right. So much comes from that. You actually aren't afraid to say this isn't right for me, because you studied law. Am I right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's sort of what I talk about in the book, is like that fear of failure is like that's the biggest thing for, well, the biggest thing holding a millennial back, I think, is that fear of failure. Because nowadays it's such a sprint to get to where you want to be so quickly that any sort of change in career path or change in life choice is just seen as a massive failure. And it's that idea of like, why would you want to win like an Oscar when you're 50? Because you can't look good in the photos. You want to be like Jennifer Lawrence and win it young and look great. But then like, where do you go from there? That's the, do you mean, that's a scary thing for me. If you're a pop star and you're 21 and you've got like a platinum selling album, what do you do now? There's nowhere to go. So I think that failure thing's a big thing. And it was a big thing in my life for a long time. I was worried that like, I kept on making mistakes and doing things wrong. And I worried about it. I thought, no one else seems to be messing up as regularly as I do. And it's come into that epiphany of like, oh, actually, I feel like adult life is, there is no like definition of, there is no moment where it just goes ping and you're an adult now and you know what you're doing. What it is you do things, you change your mind, you do things wrong, and it's how you overcome those challenges yourself. That's what being an adult is. And not having to turn to someone or blame something else, whether it is your upbringing or immigrants or anything, and just looking at yourself and going, right, what can I do to solve this situation for me?
Well, there's no power without responsibility, right? So absolutely, lots of things happen to, you know, and life is really unfair. And, you know, some people have, you know, started, depending on whatever, how they were born with more, you know, higher IQ or better looks or more access to, but the whole point is if all of those things are external, then I feel really disempowered, and the focus on those things actually almost de-skills me, because then I get to kind of complain about that. But kind of saying, what can I do despite, or what can I do? And again, it's brilliant, because if I think of where you were at that point, you're kind of ticking all those boxes. You've got into uni, you're doing a law degree, and then you're like, yeah, I'm going to go into comedy, right? But so how was that? That's brave. Like, how did you...
But again, this is the upside of how I was brought up. I don't think it was necessarily brave. Like, law, the reason I'd done law at university was for the simple reason that, like, I done quite well at school, and I was the first person of my family to go to university, and I'd done well enough at school that I could do law or medicine. And I thought, I'm not going to be a doctor, that's mad.
So rude. No, I'm joking.
But like, you know, I just thought, I can't deal. You can't, people's lives can't depend on me. That is far too much responsibility. So I thought, so it was just a default thing. Yeah. You got the grades to go to university, ergo you go to university. You got the grades to go to the hardest thing to get into at university, so obviously you do that thing at university. And then I sort of went for uni, and even at uni I didn't know anyone from my family or like friends that went to university, so I didn't know what you did at university. And like, even writing my dissertation, I didn't meet with my dissertation advisor or anything, because no one told me you could do that.
Wow.
So I just done it.
Wow. You literally never met with your...
I think at the start, she told me what to write about, and then I wrote about it. Like, I didn't think you could ask a lecturer, like, oh, could you expand on this? I just went.
Wow.
I just went and met people and went to classes sometimes and didn't others and got through it. And then at university, there was a theatre, and they did an improv comedy class, so I just went to that. And, like, it was mad. I've never told anyone. I'd get ridiculed by people that from my background they knew I'd done that, but I loved it. And then from that led to stand up, and then I started doing stand up. And then when I'd done stand up, I was like, oh, I get it now. This is like doing something that matters. This is what it feels like to, you know, have something that means something to you. Like, and I've never had that before, really. I'd liked all sports, but I was never that good at them or that fussed by them. I was quite academic, but not because I loved it and I studied hard. I just was luckily naturally quite, I can basically remember stuff. That's essentially what I can do. And then the first time I'd done comedy, I was like, oh, right, I need to get good at this. Like, I need this.
Got very good. I've done good and I've done fine.
I would have normally said I've done okay, but given what we're talking about, I need to be more positive.
Good. Okay, before we get back to the brilliant chat with the amazing Ian Sterling, I just want to give you a quick word from our sponsors, the people that are sponsoring this episode. They are Milk and More, and this is a really cool online service that's carrying on the legacy of that very British tradition of the milkman. So what they do is they deliver fresh milk and a selection of, you know, artisan and handcrafted food straight to your door. And what I like about this company is that they're really passionate about supporting local suppliers from all over the country. In a way, they want to have a positive impact not only on local communities, but also on the environment. So they're very careful about how they deliver their products. So all their milk bottles are delivered in reusable bottles straight to your door. And these glass bottles, they can be reused on average 25 times. So, you know, it's much better for the environment. You're not polluting with plastic. Again, their food selection includes a huge range of things. They've got cakes, they've got, you know, your eggs, your bacon, all the stuff that you'd have for breakfast. And it's straight from British farms right to your door. And the great thing is with Milk and More, you just order online and wake up with it waiting for you on your doorstep, usually before 7 a.m. And if you need to change an order, there's plenty of time. So you can do this up until about 9 p.m. the night before the delivery is due. Now, if you want to go and do this, all you have to do is register directly from their website. Just visit milkandmore.co.uk, and that's it. It's simple to use, and it lets you get the best of British bottled at milkandmore.co.uk. So that's really interesting. I want to move into kind of your toolkit now. So when you think about a moment, that sort of seminal crossroads, and it can be good or bad, was that your moment, or was there something that you think, aha, this was definitive for me?
Weirdly, it was basically my seminal moment, and I write about it in the book, was when I swore a child at a television recording for a children's television programme. Which, and I, as a comedian, obviously, that it is quite funny, and the story is hilarious. But what it was is, I was doing a bit of stand-up. I was doing some children's television, and I'd just come out of like a 4-year relationship. And again, it was that idea of, I decided not to do law and do stand-up. My parents were really supportive, so it just, that was fine. You can do that. If you need to stay with off, that's fine. About 6 months into the stand-up, when I was still at university, I got this job on children's television. Like, it just landed on my lap. And even that, I auditioned for it. Didn't really want to go, so they paid for my flights to London. I was skint, so I was like, I'll take a flight to London, absolutely. Yeah. And then, like, when I auditioned for it, you were meant to do, like, write a script for it. And I hadn't done it because I didn't bother. And they were like, do you want to go upstairs and do it now? And I was like, well, if I do it now, it'll be rubbish. I'll not bother. Then they still got the job. And it'd fallen on my lap. And then I was in this relationship with this wonderful woman who's still wonderful and amazing. We still talk. And we'd got a house together. I was in America at the time. She'd sorted all that. And I went for this breakup, and I was doing this kids TV, and I was like, I need to walk away from the kid. I like the kids TV and I still do it, but it wasn't fulfilling what I wanted. And I remember being backstage at that gig, which had gone, obviously, as you can understand, it didn't go great after that, swearing at an 8-year-old thing.
Can you tell us what actually...
Can I swear on this
please,
podcast?
Please, swear away.
Essentially, I walked on stage. So I'll give you the full... So the BBC wanted to do a pilot for our children's version of the show Live at the Apollo.
Okay.
So Stand Up for Kids. And I've done loads of Stand Up for Kids. Because I was a kids TV presenter and a stand-up comedian, I was like front runner to do it. So they asked me to do it. Now normally Stand Up for Children is like a family gathering. There's like a little 200-seater arts centre. There's all families there. 4 or 5 comedians. They tell their jokes. And the whole idea is like it's stand-up without the swear words. That's the whole point. I get to this gig and that isn't the case. We're in a 1,000-seater theatre. But because the BBC hadn't booked kids gigs before, they just assumed it was children, so they just bust in like 1,000 8-year-olds. And obviously it's a purely psychological thing. Children don't have the same call and response and empathy and just knowledge of like
social skills
to hear a joke and laugh or clap. Like, the whole thing was, I was also the only comedian they'd booked because the CBBC were worried about too many comedians, so it turned into this sort of variety show, but they'd made me the headline act. So before me there was a couple that had like juggled fire, obviously children loved that. The pop star Connor Maynard, children lost their mind. And then there was 4 pantomime horses and a full choir, and the pantomime horses were performing Riverdance.
Whoa!
So the kids have lost their mind, like they love it.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously. But then I've got to go on. by this point, it's a filming. It's gone on for 2.5 hours. They're tired. They've seen, and I was what a man, what a bloke walks on. And I talked to this kid. I tried to get a bit of chat with this kid, and the kid's name was Farquhar, which just blew my mind. And after I talked to Farquhar, the room got like really quiet, and I left to nothing. And I was speaking to my friend Steve afterwards about what had happened. And basically, I didn't realise it, but I'd walked on stage and gone, "All right, mate, what's your name?" He'd said Farquhar, and I'd went, "Farquhar, that's a fucking great name." But hadn't realised I'd said it. So then just carried on. So I was just in this dressing room after that. I mean, there's also a horrible bit that I had a lapel mic on, like a little clip on mic, because it was for television. Yeah. And I started talking about all this and going, oh shit. And they hadn't turned the mic off.
Oh my God.
So the whole conversation was piped into the room.
To the whole room?
Yeah, it's me going, oh shit. Oh no.
Oh my gosh.
And after that moment, I was like, right, I can't. I have just been like 4 years of coasting. Like, I'd never at any point gone, I'm going to do this. So then I eventually left. I was in a thing called, well, the CBBC office, it was called the broom cupboard back in the day for older generations. And I just walked away from it and started doing stand-up. And I got, like, I was a tour support for a guy called Russell Kane, who was really kind to me and sorted me out for that. And that was the first time ever where, because you say it was brave to walk away from university. It wasn't brave at all. Like, it was 2009. It was a year after the credit crunch. There was no jobs. Mm-hmm. There was literally no jobs. Well, in law.
Yeah.
I was getting paid a little bit of money to do stand-up. Everyone's done a gap year now. I'd never done one. My parents said, you can do a gap year and see me getting the kids to have stand-up works. This kid show landed on my lap. It was 5 days a week, full-time job on the telly. I moved to London. Like, there was no bravery in it. And it was actually saying to the kids TV, look, this isn't, I don't like what I've become. I don't like what this makes me feel. So I changed, and that was the first time ever where I went, right, how do I do something that'll affect actual change in my life?
So that was
becoming a full-time comedian after I'd done a bad comedy, which is also, now I've thought about it, I had a bad stand-up gig and then thought to myself, I'll do that full-time.
But that's what I mean. But look, to me, like, you know, that's not the go-to thing, you know, like the way that, you know, they say in psychology, past performance predicts future behavior. And what that means is we learn, right? You have a bad pizza, you stay away from pizza. That's how we develop phobias and avoidance. And what I love about what you did is that you had this moment that could have gone, you know, one of two ways. You could have been like, well, this is ridiculous. You know, I'm not doing this right. It's bad for me. And I'm going to, maybe log in. But what you said is you pivoted in a way that with insight, you were like, what do I take away? What, you know, what do I take away from this? How do I become better? How do I learn from this? And I think to me, when people speak about perfectionism, that's unrealistic. The only thing that ever gets you is never feeling like you're good enough. What you did is something different. You were able to have that self-reflection and an honesty, because I think that's the other thing that I think underlies just the reading that I've done about you, just kind of that kind of integrity of spirit to say, you know, I can or I can't do this, you know, and I need to take that risk. And it's a calculated risk, but it's one that comes from a place of being, you know, of knowing thyself at the risk of getting too deep.
Yeah, no, totally.
You know, and that, so when I hear that, I think your moment was about knowing thyself, I guess, right?
Is that? Yeah, well, it's about knowing fundamentally what's going to make you a happy person and then stop worrying about the external factors that people tell you are important.
Yeah.
Money.
Yeah.
Success, fame, none of that works. Like, I'm not, do you mean, I've always had, like, you mean, I'm like a sort of like rock and roll comedian light. Like, I've had a little bit of success. Like, I've done a little bit of, like, you know, drugs and alcohol and, you know, and all the rest of it. And the thing you realize is that none of it works. And it's really hard to realise that when you turn on the telly and everyone's like, buy this car and you'll be so happy.
Yeah.
And then the thing is, I think Naomi Klein talks about it, like this idea of, like, the way that branding changed in the 80s from, like, you know, where companies would know, like, McDonald's don't sell, like, a burger with a toy in the box. They sell, like, the idea of loving it. Like, Nike's not trainers, you're just doing it. And that buys into companies' profit margins so well, because once you buy the trainers and you've not lost any weight and you don't feel any better about yourself, what do you do? Well, you've got to buy more trainers. I think the big thing for me is happiness is not like the end result. It's how you work at how you're getting there. So once you take away the outcome,
yeah,
and then you think, right, what is actually going to work for me here? That's when you get down to the nuts and bolts of what will actually work. Like if you're in a relationship, you're like, oh, if I break up, I'll have to like move out, or I'll feel sad a bit. If you take away what's going to come next and think, right, what do I want right now? Then you get much closer to making like informed decisions.
I think you're spot on. You know, I always find it fascinating. We kind of think we're reacting to external events, but actually we're reacting to our internal processes based on that event, right? So if I feel really anxious that I don't have that car, it's not the not having the car that's giving me pain, it's the anxiety that I feel. And why do I feel that anxiety? Because somewhere I've bought into the idea that I need the car, the girl, the whatever it is, it's gonna, and it's hard to break it down because everywhere, you know, it's all about, it's a checklist, right? It's a checklist of you should be happy. Well, look at you. You're good looking. You're successful. Well, what's your problem? I think that, you know, I can't tell you how many people sit across from me and almost apologize for being there because they're like, well, I should be fine because
I find that really funny with mental illness as well. That thing about like, but you're successful. Yeah. I love the idea of like if someone broke their leg and you're like, what do you mean you broke your leg? You're good looking. You're successful.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, why? How did this happen?
Completely. There's no entitlement over it. And I think it's because it's this misunderstanding. So what are the things that you use and what are your comforts? What's in your toolkit that gets you through like the hardest moments?
Well, I mean, again, it's going to sound very samey, but stand-up comedy is so important to me because it's my passion and it's what drives me. Like, I really like this talk about by Simon Sinek where he talks about finding your why. And he applies it to companies. So basically, a lot of companies know what they do and how they do it, but they don't know why they do it.
Oh, wow, okay.
And if you find out why you do something, then you'll become much more successful. And then you'll have like staff retention.
Yeah.
Because if everyone's doing something for the same reason, then they're all working, singing from the same hymn sheet. And like, no one buys an Apple computer over a Windows because of what they're doing or how they do it. It's because of why they're doing it, you know? Like if you go to a meeting for like Microsoft, they'll be like, how do we sell more copies than Apple? Mm. If you go to an Apple conference, it'll be like, how do we make school education better? Mm. Or how do we, you know, connect people easier? How can someone connect their Wi-Fi to everyone else in the room? They're always thinking of the bigger picture. And if you think of that as a human being, like rather than what you're doing, how you do it, you think, why am I doing it? If you can find out your essential why, and it's not easy. And if you're always feeding that, then you'll always be fine, I think.
Yeah.
I always want to be a better comedian. When I swore at that kid, that gig, I got material out of it and I learned probably don't do that again. And I became a better comedian because of that gig. So although that event was pretty unfortunate, I still feel like I've benefited myself as a human being. So the stand-up's always my why. Stand-up's also important because something can happen to me that day that's horrible or sad or funny or good, and I can go on stage and talk about it immediately, which I think can be good and bad. I think sometimes it can be bad because then you've got that little pressure valve release and maybe you don't deal with it on a deep enough level. Like if you go for a breakup and then write a show about going for a breakup and everyone laughs and you go, oh, look, everyone must experience this as well, you feel better about it. But have you fundamentally sorted the heart inside? Maybe not, but it's definitely good for that. So yeah, my work, my stand-up. And as of this year, yoga.
Oh, you started doing yoga?
Yeah, Bikram, baby.
Ah, so what is Bikram specifically then, is it?
Well, from what I can gather, is you go in a really hot room and do things that I can't do.
Oh, wow.
But I try my bloody best, Linda, I tell you that for free. But yeah, it's just breathing, stretching and breathing in a really hot room.
Okay.
And I've not been to the gym in years. It's that thing, you normalise something. I used to think, oh, you don't feel better because you do exercise. You absolutely feel better if you... Yeah. I hate... Yeah. If you've seen... If anyone's listened to this who's seen my stand-up, they will know how anti in shape I am. But annoyingly, it's really bloody good.
It's true, right?
It's so annoyingly true. And the thing I love about Bikram... Because I still vape, so I know that's probably not great for you, but I stopped smoking. The thing I loved about smoking was always the exhale.
Yes,
I love that. That's what I like. And in yoga, you can do the breathing techniques and you feel great. And then that feeling, when you've been in a hot room for an hour and a half and you walk outside in the cold air and have water, I feel like...
Amazing.
I feel like... I feel like I've just done acid. I feel incredible.
But you know what? There's reams of research like on the biochemistry that. And the thing with yoga, it's like you've got the exercise, but you also have the mindfulness, right? So I think the reason that it is so good, you know, the risk and like I guess I'm like you. I'm not. I talk a lot about exercise and the importance of it, but I'm not great at doing it. But the few times that I have done it. It works, right?
It's incredible. There's like a few minutes after a yoga class where you're encouraged to lie on the floor. And I love lying down anyway. Yeah, yeah. So this is like amazing. Wait. And you get to just close your eyes and you have a few minutes to yourself and you're like proud of yourself that you've done exercise. Yeah, yeah. And you're all hot and sweaty and you've been focusing on your breathing for an hour and a half and you just have a few minutes of just nothing.
No.
And in this day and age, and this isn't even a generational thing, we never have nothing. Ah. Every relationship you've ever had is in your pocket through the medium of a mobile phone all the time. And then when I do yoga for that like 5 minutes afterwards, I've just got nothing for like 5 minutes and it's amazing.
There is something about that.
And I've lost a stone.
It's so darn hot in there.
I look so fat. I get so many likes on Instagram now, Linda. It's incredible.
Hey, as long as you're getting the likes, my friend, it's all about... No, I think there is definitely something to exercise. But I love the idea of finding your why, because I think, again, it's so formulaic what happiness looks like that we rarely stop to ask, do I want what I've been told that I want? And what's the motivation? And having that, I think it's yours. There's something about that being just yours. And that's why, you know, I loved when you said that, because I think so many... I think there's all these cat posters out there, right? That tell you how to think and feel and just feel like all these platitudes. But when you find what it means to you, for whatever reason it is for you, and again, not being scared that it might not be the perfect thing. Like you said, there might be times when, and I don't think it's mutually exclusive, but I think you can, you know, do something that feels good in short term and in the long term. But sometimes it might be just for the short term.
Short term stuff's great.
It's okay. But it's about that honesty and the acknowledgement.
The why thing can be anything as well. Like your why could be like, I've got lots of friends like I met at university, they've got children now, and they're fundamentally better people for it because that's their why now, to make sure their kids have a nice life, you know? Your why doesn't have to be, I want to win a Nobel Peace Prize. Your why can be, I want to have a nice allotment. And even that means, if you're at work and if you hate your job, that's maybe something you need to look at. But if you're having a crap day at work, you can think to yourself, well, I'll get to buy a new trowel. You know, there's always if you have a fundamental thing that makes you absolutely blissfully happy, then you'll always be working towards that and it will help at all times.
That. And finally, tell me about a challenge, sort of a goal that you set yourself. How do you orientate yourself? I always kind of think of, I think most people that I speak to that are ambitious, that have done well, what I find is interesting is many times they kind of focus on where they're going. And I think sometimes, and this is very true of millennials as well, I think that there's always like, I could be doing more. Because you never see how far you've come from. You just see where you haven't gone yet. And we stop. So for you, I mean, you've done brilliantly in terms of pacing the career in a way that it's done very well, but also you seem very well adjusted in it. How do you set goals so they don't consume you or that, you know, they still bring you
forward? Well, I think, and I know this is like, it's such a trope of a millennial, but I am particularly bad at not being consumed by something to the extent that I don't do enough work. I think, and I wonder if it's a defense mechanism.
Okay.
Because I think sometimes I do wonder that I don't know yet if there's been a single project where I've walked away from it going, there is nothing left here.
Mm-mm.
And also that is maybe as a bit of a defense mechanism, because if you don't try hard enough at something and it's not good,
it's okay,
you've got an immediate get out of jail free card.
Yeah.
I'm filming a special for Comedy Central tonight, and I've been sat in my house playing computer games today and I've come in on this podcast, which is a joy, and then I'll go back and I'll have an hour to get showered and shave and look presentable and then go and do it. And if it goes badly, I can go, well, I didn't try. That's the easiest way. If it doesn't go well, I can go, well, if I had tried, that would have been great. And if I'm on with three other comedians, if any of them do better in my head, I can go, well, I bet they tried. their hardest.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but then maybe that's just me. That's just my personality. I don't know, but I do worry if that's like a defense mechanism. So I think the hurdle I want to overcome is to find a because I've always been spread out. Like I said, my parents would take me to everything. So I'm when it comes to sport, I'm not quite good. I'm not terrible at a number of sports. I'm not good at any sports. I feel like I want to now, in the next part of my career, is to I want to focus in on something. Probably the stand-up, although I did quite enjoy writing as well. And make that the thing that become... I want that to be, you know what I mean, not the best in the world. Maybe it'll never even be in the top half. But I want to be able to... When I'm not a stand-up anymore, to have a tangible thing that I can go, that has everything I've ever... I couldn't have made that better. That's as good as it can be. And I've not got that yet.
Okay. So it's about kind of looking for that thing that kind of speaks to not just who you are, but what you're good at, what you can focus on, just all of that.
I want to make something which is the focus on the my best natural aspects, which I think comes with stand-up.
Yeah.
And I know that I... put my most effort into it. Yeah. So I'm not coasting on like a natural ability like I did at university and school.
Yeah.
I didn't try at school. I just remembered stuff the night before and wrote it out down again. I found it really like easy.
Yeah, yeah.
University I didn't find easy. That was really hard and I'd done terribly. But I wanted to find something that I feel like I'm good at and that I put my all into.
Maybe overcome this fear of failure because you're...
I think it is still there, you know. Yeah. I definitely think there is an aspect of my personality to this day that still thinks... I almost genuinely sometimes think of... I sometimes worry that, like... I've even found it in, like, stuff that's come up in my career. The things that I really want, I tend to not get. And then the things that I don't want sort of fall in my lap. Like the kids' TV thing. Yeah. I couldn't have cared less if I got that or not. And that's probably why in the audition I was good.
Yeah.
And then even I've done a voiceover on this, like, ITV show, Love Island reality TV show. I just didn't want that. I said no to that a number of times. I didn't even audition for it.
Yeah.
But I'm good at it. So then there's maybe I've got this
thing. Can I say you're amazing at it? I watched it for the first time this summer. Hilarious.
Thank you.
Amazing.
But like, yeah, I want to just... and then there's other things that I've really wanted and maybe I've wanted to the audition. I've been a bit nervous. It's not gone as well as I would have liked.
This is like one of those things where the solution becomes part of the problem though. And I think again, from a psychological point of view, you're kind of raising something that's really common. You're right. When you're afraid, you know, fear of failure protects because you avoid, so there's something else to focus it on. But I think on the other hand, like you say, to me, this is so incongruent with everything else that you've done, because everything that's good that is sort of fall in your lap. I think just kind of hearing about your life, you know, a lot of the good stuff has come from you just being true to you and maybe kind of, you know, I don't know, it's a scary thing, but actually what's the worst that can happen? That's one of my favorite psychological techniques. You know, when I'm afraid of something, what's the worst case scenario?
Yeah.
If I try my best and it doesn't do well, does this say something like a global, you know, truth about me? You know, does failing mean I'm a failure? Does doing something bad mean I'm bad? I think we've got to be careful of how we internalize successes and failures. I think that's what the most toxic thing is, that, you know, it's like as if you do something good, will you just stop trying? Go, that's it, I've done it good, that's it, I can stop trying. You're not going to do that. Likewise, it's the stuff that doesn't work as well. And well, for what it's worth, I think you're brilliant. Thank you so much
for
coming on.
I feel like I've done much better this time than I did last time.
You're amazing both times. It was a pleasure. And please, can you tell everyone where they can find you? Just
I live in London. You can find me there. on Twitter and Instagram, Ian Does Jokes, IAIN Does Jokes. I've got my book is called Not Ready to Adult Yet, and it's available now.
And it's amazing. Please pick it up. Thank you so much.
No, you're welcome. Thank you, Linda. Thank you.
What an interesting guy. I found his comments insightful and thoughtful. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I think Ian touched on some really interesting things there. Towards the end, he actually touched on failure. Now, this is something that I'm always harping on about, this fear of failure that we have in our society. And I think, I did a podcast on this recently. So if you are interested in finding practical ways to cope with it, I would urge you to kind of scroll back and download that, because, you know, I think being able to stand up to the bullying bully in our head that's telling us, you know, what if, and helping sort of hold us back is really key. So take a look at that. But also take a look at Ian's book. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's called Not Ready to Adult Yet. It's both very funny, but again, like he is, it's very intelligently and insightfully written. Thank you so much for listening. Always love to hear from you. So please rate, review. You know where we are now. Audio Boom, Apple Podcasts. Please subscribe, tell your friends. And until we meet again, I wish you a very happy, healthy body and mind.